Coming up on Broadway Radio, this week on Broadway, we talk with Jennifer Simard and Kurt Peterson. We review Curious Incidents of the Dog in the Nighttime, Fun Home, and do our hero waltz at City Center Encores. That plus more. Please stay tuned.
It's the little things you share together.
Swear together.
Wear together.
That make perfect relationships. The concerts you enjoy together.
Neighbors you annoy together. Children you destroy together. That keep marriage intact.
It's not so hard to be married. It's much the simplest of crimes.
It's not so hard to be married.
I've done it 3 or 4 times.
It's sharing little winks together.
Drinks together.
Kinks together. That make marriage a joy.
It's bargains that you shop together.
Cigarettes you stuff together.
Clothing that you swap together.
That make perfect relationships.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 15, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Astute listeners will notice that there's a slight change in Michael's bio there. So Everything Sondheim, tell us about Everything Sondheim.
Everything Sondheim is a reconstituted version of the very valuable resource, the Sondheim Review, that has been around for years. It's going to be much more of a web-based presence now, although they are still going to have hard copy magazines, I believe, twice a year rather than 4 times a year. And they have just completed they did some kind of crowdfunding, and they've completed that. And I think it's going to be launching officially very soon. So look forward to that.
Great. Please keep us up to date on that. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be interested in Everything Sondheim.
Yes.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Jennifer Simard is with us. Broadway fans know Jennifer from the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, Shrek the Musical, Sister Act, and Disaster. And lots of other things that we will get into in a bit. But Jennifer, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and visiting with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I love a Sunday morning in New York City. It's probably the only time the city sleeps, or at least wakes up slowly and groggily, and everyone goes and gets their bagels. And I love it. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, I have the Ninth Avenue Food Festival outside my door.
Oh,
so.
My sympathies. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and it's also a challenging thing. I understand.
Yes, it is.
If you live nearby, yes, sir.
All right, Jennifer, I remember seeing you in Nonsense way back when in Boston when you were Sister Mary Amnesia. Nuns have been a part of your life for a while, right?
That's right. I actually did it in New Hampshire first. And funnily enough, Dan Goggin, the creator of Nonsense, sent a care package to the Nederlander Theater. And I might as well have been 19 years old again. I just was shrieking and jumping up and down because I would have given anything to have FaceTime with him all those years ago. And then I get a gift from him, and we've been in touch, and we're probably going to have coffee. And, I was raised Catholic, so nuns, to some degree, they're a part of my DNA, I think. But I've never had the good fortune of playing one quite so challenging and weird and wonderful.
You're in a fairly unusual position, so I'd love to ask you about what's it like to be nominated for major awards for the same performance in 2 different seasons?
You mean having been nominated for the off-Broadway shows?
Exactly.
Yes. Well, it's wonderful. I'm certainly it's not the first time a show has transferred to Broadway, and I'm just so delighted that the role and that it's resonating with people. You just want to do your art as best you can and leave it at that. And you never know what people's opinion is going to be. So the fact that people seem to be responding to it is gravy. just frosting on the already huge, gigantic, gooey cake that I love so much. I'm very flattered, and I appreciate it very much.
So you've been nominated for Disaster in 2014 at the Drama Desk, on the Drama Desk side 2 years ago, and you,
yes.
So you've carried this role on for many, many years, it seems.
Yes, I was lucky enough in 2014 to receive a Drama Desk and Drama League nomination, and I believe I was... the Drama League is structured such that you're still eligible if it transfers, and that's what happened this year, and I'll be attending that luncheon next Friday. And I'm so happy to... I love the Drama League luncheon because it gives all the nominees about a 30-second moment to thank people. And I think if you ask anyone, the best part of winning an award, I've never won an award, but I was just saying that I would imagine the best part is actually being able to... I would imagine the best part is being able to thank the people that helped you get there, because you never accomplish something like this by yourself. It doesn't happen in a vacuum or a bubble. And so truly that, I remember my mother, before she passed away, she attended each of the Drama Desk ceremonies since 1997 and the last one in 2014, and she passed that October. And that was a win in and of itself. To be nominated is truly the honor. But the only regret I have is that I wasn't able to publicly thank her, because she was a huge reason why I was here. That's all. So the Drama League, to finish my point, is wonderful because everyone gets a little moment to thank their people. And isn't that lovely? Because it's our team and our peeps that deserve the credit, honestly.
So 97, you did I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. In 2004, you did The Thing About Men. 2005, mm-hmm. Forbidden Broadway, Special Victims Unit. And 2014, yes. Of course, Disaster. So 1997 to 2016, you're an overnight sensation, right?
I am. I think I've read in print that this is the fourth time in my career that I'm a newcomer. I love it every time. It's like the unknown and newcomer, and it makes me giggle, and I love it, and I love just being a sort of invisible character actress. It kind of means I'm doing my job well, and I'm happy about it.
I was just going to say that, and all kidding aside, I think large part of the reason for that is that you are so different in all of these shows.
Thank you.
And you really disappear into the roles, and you really create completely different characters.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks to Peter and Michael both. Michael wrote that wonderful Forbidden Broadway book and put me in it. And Peter, I've known since I was from the Star Ledger days, I want to say. I hope I'm not saying that incorrectly, but I remember performing in Teaneck when I Love Your Perfect Now Change premiered out there, and we were making all of $214 a week. And you've always been such a supporter of mine. I know that part of your job is to be objective, but I've always felt appreciative when people see you, and it feels like I've grown up in this career with these people. So when I do interviews like this, it does feel like I'm talking to old friends, and I'm really appreciative.
Nice.
So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I remember very vividly I Love You, Perfect Now Change at the American Theater Group out there. And that was quite a night, you know, no question, because that audience was with you every step of the way. And it was just so wonderful to see it happen.
Thank you.
So tell us about...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say it was Fairleigh Dickinson University, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, not at all. So the different parts of the business, you know, takes you into all sorts of, you know, there is no daily routine for an actor, is there? And so, you know, your routine right now is pretty much to go from interview to interview and from ceremony to ceremony. And so what's that going to be like for the next couple of weeks? You mentioned you have the Drama League coming up.
Yes, there's almost something every day. And I think the routine is just to try to keep your head screwed on straight and stay centered and keep perspective about, you know, keeping yourself healthy and keeping your loved ones close and just trying to do a good job representing yourself and the show that you were lucky enough to be a part of. And, just enjoying the moment and trying to be a kind person through it all. You know, it can be, especially those people who are still doing eight shows a week, it can be exhausting. It's a, it's a full-time job in and of itself, and so you have to be very kind to yourself and gentle if you say the wrong thing or you wear the wrong thing or you just have to be, you know, a good person and just smile through it all and, you know, keep your perspective and your balance. That's all.
Are you prepared for the big evening? I know that people stress out about how they are going to, you just said, wear the right thing, wear the wrong thing. And
yeah.
Have you been to the big dance before?
I have three times, once as a guest and twice to perform with, I was lucky enough to perform with both Shrek the Musical and Sister Act. So I'm aware of what those, you know, what's involved. And I guess the best thing I would think, it's just my opinion, is that there is no right or wrong. If you feel comfortable in your own skin, then that is correct. And what everyone else thinks doesn't really matter. And I have a great team that's helping me, and I'm really appreciative of their help, just to alleviate some of the question marks. And yeah, I'm really honored, and I'm so grateful to the Tony nominating committee for choosing me this year. I don't envy them. This was such a full season, and in my category alone, there were so many beautiful performances. Those who were nominated and those who weren't, and I'm sure they would have loved more if they could. You know, that's the way mm-hmm. it goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you have been at the Tonys in the past, were they all at Radio City, or have you been to the at the beginning?
I've done both. I actually performed once at Radio City and once at the Beacon. But, you know, I lived at 75th and Broadway for 10 years. So I'm quite delighted it's at the Beacon, because the Beacon Theater is a bit personified for me. It's like looking at an old friend. So I feel mm-hmm. very fortunate that it's there.
All right. So how did it all start for you? Were you one of these little girls who saw Annie and suddenly that took off for you?
Yes and no. I was lucky enough to grow up with a beautiful vaudevillian theater 20 minutes from my home, the Palace Theater in Manchester, New Hampshire. And my parents took us kids one summer, and I think Fiddler on the Roof was the first show I saw. And I pulled my mother's coat and said, "Mommy, I don't want to be up here. I want to be down there." And then I loved school. I was a pretty well-rounded kid, and I started doing theater maybe at school at 7, and then with a professional group at 9, though I was not professional. And then I'd say around 11, my interests kind of diverged, and there was a question if I would do this for a living. And I think it wasn't until I was 16 years old that I really decided this was it for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where did you say where you were from? I didn't know if you had mentioned that.
I was born in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I grew up in a little town called Litchfield, New Hampshire, which is a little country town just on the outskirts of Manchester. And it was a lovely, lovely place to grow up, very quiet, and just an hour north of Boston. So there was a lot of culture in the surrounding areas, and I was very fortunate upbringing.
Oh, no. Are you a Red Sox fan?
I have a funny story. I love baseball, period. And my parents were Red Sox Nation. They met on a ball field at 13 and 15. And my brothers and I bought them a brick at Fenway Park. A few years ago, we had the opportunity to do that. And I think we said, "Roland and Yvette Simard, baseball equals love." My mom met Ted Williams. He found her peanut bag. And I remember in 1996, I was doing I Love Your Perfect Now Change. It just opened. And, of course, the Yankees were just exploding. I think they won a couple years in a row, and it was huge. And my parents came into town for the Thanksgiving Day parade, and I was standing at Columbus Circle, and of course they were coming down in the parade, and I screamed, "Oh, my team, my team!" And my dad said, "Okay, you've just killed me. How could you say that?" So the truth is, I love baseball. I love the Mets, I love the Yankees, I love the Red Sox, and I'm sorry if that makes me a bad person, but I love baseball, period.
That's what I'm doing here. do you have some sort of secret society with Carrie O'Malley? You know?
Oh, I love Carrie. Now, Carrie, this is funny. She grew up in Nashua, New Hampshire, which is 30-minute drive from where I grew up. And we didn't know each other as kids. I knew Sarah Silverman growing up. We did theater together, but I never knew Carrie. And my first job that moved me to the city, I actually did with Carrie's aunt, Regina O'Malley. Isn't that strange? Person that I grew up so close to. And I love Carrie, and we're in touch now as colleagues and adults from the, because, you know, when you're from the same area, it does bond you in a way. you know.
There's something in the water up in that area and in the Pittsburgh area just generating lots of good talent.
Thank you.
And so where did you go to school?
I went to the Boston Conservatory of Music, but I did not graduate. I got the opportunity to work, and I chose that. And it was a tough decision, but I don't think anyone knows you better than yourself, and I knew that that was the right thing, and it's worked out. And around 2000, I went back to Hunter College just for myself, and I took a lot of classes in science and math, and I really liked going back to school as an adult. It sort of made me feel, believe it or not, closer to my acting career. You know, it helped inform just to be well-rounded, and I think I got more out of it than I would have at 20 years old. That was my path. I don't necessarily recommend that, but I recommend listening to your gut, I guess.
I went back to school as an adult, and I was like, wow, I really blew it as a kid. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed school as an adult.
That was my experience, yeah.
I will let you get back to coffee and bagels and relaxation on this beautiful Sunday morning turning into afternoon in New York. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us, and best of luck on the Tony Awards.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, bye-bye.
See you soon.
It's not so hard to be married. It's much the simplest of crimes. It's not so hard to be married.
I've done it 3 or 4 times.
It's sharing little winks together.
Drinks together.
Kinks together. That make marriage a joy.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Kurt Peterson is joining us from his home by telephone. And Broadway fans will know Kurt from just a long list of amazing, amazing performances. We talk about Kurt began his Broadway career when Leonard Bernstein and Richard Rodgers chose him to play Tony in the revival of West Side Story at Lincoln Center. He then starred opposite Angela Lansbury in Dear World and created the role of young Ben in Stephen Sondheim's Follies. Off-Broadway, Kurt starred in Dames at Sea by Bernstein and Alias Jimmy Valentine and appeared in the Town Hall productions of Knickerbocker Holiday, Music in the Air, and I Married an Angel. I could go on and on, but we only have so much time. Kurt, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and visiting with us.
Thank you. This is terrific. I'm glad to be here and talking to the three of you. Thank you.
Well, you have a CD coming out from Ghostlight Records, When Everything Was Possible, which was a concert album celebrating Broadway's golden age. So tell us about that project. How did that get started?
Well, it started... It's sort of the story in the CD itself sort of tells how it happened. Vicki and I met the first day of school at AMDA in 1966, summer 66.
Oh, wow.
Immediately bonded.
We should say we're talking about Victoria Mallory.
Yeah. And we bonded. We started to sing together back then. And then near the end of the second school year, Vicki auditioned for West Side Story for Richard Rodgers and Leonard Bernstein, and she got it after 5 auditions. Well, I didn't audition for it because my choir teacher in Wisconsin had told me when I suggested we do West Side Story that there was no one to sing Tony, so I was a little bit shy about auditioning, but she sort of encouraged me to do it, and I was a little jealous of her at the time, too, so I auditioned 5 times, and I got the role, and so our careers began together with West Side Story at Lincoln Center, and our personal life and our careers sort of dovetailed all the way through for about 8 years. We did Follies together, we did the Fantastics together all over the country, concerts together, and the tribute to Stephen Sondheim in 1973 together as well. At the end of Night Music, she fell in love with her co-star, Mark Lambert, and left New York City for quite a few years, and it was sort of an abrupt leaving, and she and I did not speak for about 35 or I think maybe almost 40 years.
Wow.
And we were reconnected through a phone call she made asking me to take care of her daughter, Ramona, who was coming to New York. And this was about 7 years ago. And I said, yes, Vicki, I will take care of your daughter and make sure she's with the right teachers, but don't you think you and I should sit down and have a conversation? And we did. and we did, and you know, we sort of vented and talked and discussed all the things that happened, and that led to us at the end of that becoming dear friends, and we said, you know, we really should sing together again, and that was the genesis of this whole project. We began to sort of make notes on what had happened in the 8 years that we were together, and the wonderful experiences we had. And also, you know, sort of sad ones and difficult ones. And the concert sort of came of those conversations and just sort of the trail of these two kids who came to New York knowing no one, and just through little persistence and stubbornness, and as I say in the concert, being, for myself, being sort of half-conscious and not knowing that I couldn't do it, we created creative lives for ourselves and performing lives for ourselves, and had the wonderful gift of being able to work with the very best of the best in the theater. And that's what this CD is about. And as one critic said, you know, anyone starting out in musical theater has to see this, or in this case, hear the CD. It, not only will you learn a lot, it'll give you hope. And that's what we're hoping to do with the CD. We did the concert on April 29th, 2012, and it was a one-night only thing, and it was just a special, special evening. And our plans were to return to New York and then do a studio recording and then tour it around the country. And we were deep into those plans when Vicki was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and passed away just a couple months after that. So fortunately, we had an archival recording of the evening, so we went to the Unions and went to a wonderful person who mastered it for us, and we put together this wonderful representation of Vicki's last New York stage performance, and with a beautiful 32-page booklet with a lot of photos that people have never seen, because I've had them in my private collection. And we've put this out into the world, and our mission is to get it to as many, not only the people of our age who remember and who might have been there, but to get it into the conservatories and schools around the country as a message of history and hope, and of course to memorialize Victoria, the wonderful Vicki, who just touched so many lives and so many people on the stage in her career. So we're very proud of it and thrilled that Ghostlight has agreed to distribute it. Ted Chapin has helped us along the way. We've had wonderful support from Hal Prince and Steve Sondheim. And you know, Jonathan Tunick did brand new orchestrations with it. Larry Moss directed it beautifully. Josh Burgess staged it. It was quite a feat, and we're so proud of it, and we want to get it out there.
Well, your concert...
Well, you should. As well, you should. The thing is that I'd like to know. Don't be so modest about saying, well, we appeared at that 73 Sondheim concert. You were the power behind that. That concert would not have happened had it not been for you. So, in my book, Broadway Most Valuable Players, I named Kurt the most valuable player of that year for starting that concert, because that's the one that really started that type of concert happening. So let's give you credit where credit is really due, because that amazing night with Nancy Walker singing I'm Still Here and so many others, and finally hearing We're Going to Be All Right in its entirety, et cetera, is all due to the man we're talking to right now.
Peter, thank you. And you've been such a wonderful cheerleader in keeping that evening and the memory of that evening alive, and I'm so grateful to you for that. You know, it's an interesting thing. I'm writing, I got this wonderful note from Hal Prince just because he received the CD, and I just want to read it to you because we're on the air here. Dear Kurt, there's no way I can express the painful jolt I experienced when receiving When Everything Was Possible. Painful and exhilarating, of course. You and Vicki are emblematic of what we all felt and still feel working and living as we have among eager, committed, creative friends. Hell, I'm gobsmacked and worried, but I can't begin to integrate the rush of emotions you've triggered. And I think that's what, you know, that's when I start thinking about the CD, some of the notes I'm getting are from people, wonderfully, Hal Prince has a wonderful way with words, but what it does, triggers is the journey that we all have as creative people who have chosen to be in this profession and had the opportunity to do this kind of thing. The other thing that CDs, I think, touches is that people say that it reminds them of their early years, too. And I once read that the very best memoir pieces, which certainly this is, trigger memories and rushes feelings and memories of the audience members, not necessarily the people on stage. Yeah. And I've always sort of held to that as a test of the effectiveness of these memoir pieces. In my note to Hal, I'm also going to tell him that, you know, Hal, I'm so thrilled that they're doing the Prince of Broadway and that it might be coming here, because you're long overdue in terms of a celebration of your contributions. Mm-hmm. I want to remind you that I asked you first when we did the benefit for Steve in the fall of 72. I said, we asked you first if we could honor you, and you said no.
So, oh well.
Oh well.
I had a wonderful little flashback yesterday, because I was at City Center for Do I Hear a Waltz?
Yes.
And which is where you did your show, you and Victoria, and then Ted Chapin took part in the talk back afterwards. Huh? And so I knew I was speaking with you today. And of course, that Do I Hear a Waltz has We're Going to Be All Right, which was which you did. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was definitely flashback yesterday for me.
Right. Right.
Mm. All right. Now, here you are. You're in the show called Follies. When does it hit you that you are in something that people are going to be still talking about 40 odd years later? When do you say, this is not just another musical, this is very special? Is it in rehearsal? Is it in Boston? Is it not until the show is closed? When?
Is it many years later?
Is it really?
Really, really. You know, as I say in the concert, you know, I was half conscious at that time. And I think that's the reason that, I can only speak for myself, but the reason the young people were hired was because life hadn't happened to them yet, you know, and they were sort of innocent, and you know, you're going to love tomorrow, everything's going to be just great. And I think that was sort of, only speaking for myself, that was part of what I felt as a human being at that point. So I didn't get Follies. I didn't really get it. Mm-hmm. Also, in rehearsals for Follies, it was very much, you know, it was very cinematic. It was very much like a movie. And we would go on stage and do little bits and be a ghost here, come off here and there. It was very, very difficult to see the flow of Follies. And I didn't really see that until I had left the show to go do On the Town. And then I went out in the audience and saw it for the first time. And at that point, I think I began to get the idea that this was something really, really special. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that in rehearsal, other than watching the wonderful, you know, the wonderful staging of Michael Bennett, all of the wonderful parts, but I didn't get the whole until I saw it. And I didn't get the real effect of Follies until many years later, when my life was a little bit more like older Ben than it was like younger Ben.
Well, not only that, but there, you know, of course, there were so many disappointments while it was happening. The fairly negative New York Times review, the loss of the best musical Tony,
yes.
the relatively short run, and I can certainly, you know, one can certainly understand why at the time a lot of people didn't realize what exactly this was.
Right, right. We knew we were in something special because of the people we were working with and seeing glimpses of it on stage, but we didn't know. What we couldn't know is the effect it had on the audience.
Mm.
And you know, and to do that last performance in New York and see hear the incredible applause, and to know that these people had seen the show 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 times.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that, but you know, I guess it took other people to sort of comment on it and get it. You know, in terms of the opening night, I mean, one of the things, I'm running this long note to Hal just to thank him for his influence in my life, and one of the things I say is, I thank you for letting me know that the New York Times is infallible. Is you know, and to know that. Because he just railed against Clive Barnes on the opening part.
Sure.
And for him to do that, it gave me sort of the ability to not give the critics that much, power, or to know that you know, the New York Times also got the Gettysburg Address wrong. So
was that right?
Between that and Follies, I take any criticism, both positive and negative, with a giant grain of salt, and just sort of began to trust my own instincts a little bit more.
Are you saying they reviewed the Gettysburg Address and they didn't like it?
They called it 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So, all right. Do you have any fond memories of the other ladies in Follies? Any nice stories about Yvonne DiCarlo, Fifi Dorsay, or any of those ladies?
Well, I'm gonna tell you. You're gonna be the first to hear this.
All right.
I'm putting together a show called Proud Ladies. Ladies. Song I
sing. The Baker's Wife. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
This is a show that I'm doing, it's called Proud Ladies, and it's called Close Encounters and Lessons Learned From, and there are 23 ladies that I'm going to.
Wow.
Including Apple, Dorothy, Alexis, and Yvonne, and so there're gonna be little stories about each one of them, and 23 others. The reason there are 23 is because at the end of the Proud Lady song, it says I'm in love.
Oh, the third time. Right, yeah.
So I've been working on that for a year, and it's hopefully gonna surface in November. But having said that, I will tell you my favorite story about Apple. I loved Apple. I just loved Apple Chate. She was such a trooper, and she would just go out there and stop the show. And Fifi Dorsay was a slightly neurotic French. I don't think she'd ever been to France, but I think she's Canadian. But she was so in her Frenchness. And she would just be so upset. And then Ethel started getting more and more applause for Broadway Baby, and Fifi less and less. And I think they structured it so Ethel got even more applause in terms of the sequence of the number. And finally, you know, and Fifi would just be dithering at the side of the stage or whatever, and Ethel one day she just had it with Fifi, and she, in the middle of rehearsal, she said, "Fifi," and she looked at her and she pointed her finger and she said, "Squattez-vous," and made her sit down in her chair and shut up, and that was the end of Fifi being so neurotic that it was disturbing rehearsals.
I'd love to ask the only one
who could kick a cat on stage. She would tipple a little bit backstage, and she would change the staging of Broadway Baby so that by the time, I think, you know, near the end of the New York run, she would say, "At my tiny flat, there's just my cat." And she would, with her foot, just kick the cat across the stage. And that wasn't a Michael Bennett thing. That was a
thing. Right.
But there are lots of wonderful stories. And Dorothy, and especially Dorothy, who I dearly, dearly loved and thought she gave one of the most wonderful performances and the very best Sally I've ever seen. Mm.
The other thing about Ethel Chate, I think it's on the famous live recording of Follies in Broadway Baby. At one point, she ad-libs, what's the line? I think working out of 5 and 10 or eating at Greece, and she's in that. She says, "Cash." She wants you to then the pay cash. Cash. I'd love to ask you about Baker's Wife, and specifically Proud Lady, but I guess that's a sterling, shining example of a cast album that kept a show alive in people's minds that might have been completely forgotten.
Totally. Thank you. And that's exactly right. In the same way, if the Sondheim evening hadn't been recorded, and that wonderful Scrabble poster wasn't created, there wouldn't have been that. The Baker's Wife. And interestingly enough, Bruce Yeko and Doris who did it, right? And it was taken And interestingly enough, the song Proud Lady was cut from the show, so no one would have ever, you know, heard that song either. And it sort of made that song, at least, you know, people are doing it around in auditions.
I'm sorry, at what point was it cut from the show? I don't think I knew that.
Yes, it was cut in San Francisco when John Barry came in.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And Stephen Schwartz was also a co-producer of the album, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That sounds right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that, which was very smart on his part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it really was.
Happened. Yeah.
Uh huh. Wow.
So the recording was made in 2012 at City Center, and
everything was possible.
Yeah, everything was possible. Thank you, Michael. We're talking about so many different.
When everything was possible. Interesting title. You know where it came from, you three, right?
Sure, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing made sense. Nothing sure, made sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Ted's book. Ted's book was
right.
Impossible. Mm-hmm. So we had to ask both Stephen and Ted, who are you know, very, very generous, if we could use it, you know, to frame the concert, and so we did.
So you were able to record the concert there, and very often when people record concerts, they leave the patter out in between. But you have your stories in there, and so this is a full experience. I don't know if you were able to. Was this before or after the renovation at City Center?
After.
Yeah. So you were able to use the new recording facilities.
Yeah, and Leon Rothenberg was our sound man, and, you know, they always make an archival thing, which is supposed to just be, you know, one CD and never supposed to hear it or whatever. And so we had to go to my wonderful co-producer, Stephanie Overton, who was the general manager over at Encores for many years, so she knew the City Center people very well. And so we had to sort of go with our tail between our legs to the musicians and the stagehands union and say, when we knew we wanted to try to do this, and say, look, we sort of made this archival recording. Can we do something with it? And they said, oh, shame on you. You shouldn't have done that. And then they said, let's make a deal. So the unions were did what they did. And you know, fortunately, we got to do it. Seymour Red Press helped us. And then the Stagehands Union. And then Jonathan was terrific. You know, he could have, we went to him, and he made it very affordable for us to do this. It still cost quite a bit of money,
sure.
And, which was raised, by the way, by over 180 donors on Fractured Atlas, which is a wonderful...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fractured Atlas is a wonderful crowdfunding site because it allows the people who donate to have a tax deduction immediately. And that's different than Indiegogo and the other ones. So, you know, you get your CD and your whatever, but you also get a tax deduction, which is important for people who give a little bit more money than, you know... it's important for everybody, but... I only wanted to do it that way. I didn't want it just people just give the money. So it's a great outfit.
You referenced the orchestrations, and I just wanted to say, hearing them live in the performance, how great they were. It wasn't a terribly large orchestra, but so well done that it sounded completely full.
And Michael Rafter, of course, is a brilliant musical director, you know, both playing the piano and conducting the orchestra. And Jonathan was so great. You know, we had three tryouts. We did it as a benefit up here in Connecticut for Little Britches, which is a disabled children's riding thing where they let disabled children ride horses, and that stimulates them. We did it up there, and then we did it in Davies, Florida. Donald Roberts brought us down to Davies, Florida. And then we did it at Triad in Greensboro, North Carolina. Tom and Linda Sloan brought us down there. And when we were in North Carolina, Jonathan went down with us, and he was with us for 3 or 4 days as we worked the orchestrations and whatever. So he's been a wonderful supporter as well. And, of course, he's so iconic in terms of our period. We did, most of them, you know. So we were thrilled to have this team assembled.
So When Everything Was Possible is now available. It was released 2 days ago, which the May 13th officially released a couple of days ago. You can get it at Chickaboom and Ghostlight Records and other fine record establishments, as you might say. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning and talking about this.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for this opportunity. I think it's just great that I get the chance to get this message out, and I'm thrilled.
Okay, so in this time during the nomination period, in between the nominations and the award ceremonies themselves, this gives us a chance to go back and visit with some shows that we've seen previously. Michael and Peter have gotten a chance to visit different shows. We'll start with Michael, who revisited The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. So, Michael, tell us about how the show is and why you went back.
The show is great. I went back primarily because now in the cast is Nancy Robinette, who's a wonderful actress who I've seen in many shows in D.C., and this is her Broadway debut. And so great to see her, you know, at a more mature age, as to someone making a Broadway debut after so much stellar work in another city like that. And that, of course, this show is so great to begin with. She doesn't have a huge amount to do in the show. She's a Mrs. Alexander, posh woman, and voice six and ensemble. Her main role is the neighbor, who one of Christopher's neighbors, who's rather lonesome, and she tries to befriend him, and he really has limited capacity to do that because he's autistic and et cetera, et cetera. And he's also investigating the death of the murder of this dog. but it really was great to see her. And she did a wonderful job in her scenes, especially with Tyler Leah. I suppose that's how it's pronounced, Tyler L-E-A, who is the new main person playing Christopher Boone. At other performances, Christopher is played by Benjamin Wheelwright. But Tyler Leah is magnificent in the role. He does it quite a different physical presence from the originator of the role, and also vocally. He's very thin. Although I'm sure he's actually older than I believe 15 is supposed to be the boy's age. He is quite believable of that age. And he was so into the character and very intense. And he very convincingly portrayed the autism as far as I was concerned. One thing that I noticed is that the way he screamed when he had his autistic meltdowns was even more harrowing than his predecessor. And I on the one hand, it concerned me a little bit just in terms of the effect on his voice, but I'm sure that's one major reason why this role has always had an alternate. It's not something that you would really want to ask someone to do eight times a week, and even six times a week is quite an achievement. But he really was just brilliant, and everyone else who I think almost everyone else in the cast is new. The show has had a wonderfully long run. I think it says a lot about the quality of a play if it's a new play without a star in it, and about a difficult subject matter, and it still manages to have a healthy run on Broadway. I think that shows you what a wonderful play we're talking about, and that's certainly true in this case, by Simon Stevens, based on the novel by Mark Haddon, directed by Marianne Elliott. The production is so inventive and clever and wonderful. I was glad to see this show again, specifically for several reasons, but one being that there's so much in it in terms of movement and information and quite a few characters. And so it's one of those things that you can't necessarily take in everything on a first viewing. So I was very, very happy to see it again. I was thrilled. I think it's held up beautifully. My only thing is that I swear, and the friend that I went with said the same thing, it seems like the volume of the music and sound effects has been ramped up considerably. And I do not, I wish that I could control this. I wish I had a master red button in my apartment where I could control the volume at the levels of these Broadway shows, because it's sometimes
borderline ridiculous. And especially in a case like this, where it seems like for much of the play, the dialogue is not amplified. If it is amplified, it's very, very, very lightly amplified. So then you have your ear having to be assaulted by all this incredibly, incredibly loud music, and then having to readjust every time the music stops and people start talking again. So I do wish – I mean, this we're now in the very home stretch of the run, and it's I believe September it's closing. Is that right?
September 4th.
Yeah. So, but for what it's worth, I wish somebody would have a look at that and revisit it and say, you know, please, please dial it back. Because other than that, it was absolutely brilliant, and I'm very, very glad to have seen it again.
You know, it could be the board op for the evening that you were there.
Yes, as we discussed with Waitress, you know, you never know. And especially in a case like this where it's a long-running show. As I said, with Waitress, we saw it like two nights after it opened. So one would think there would have been maybe more control in that case. But it could still be a new person or whatever.
Yeah.
The director would still probably not necessarily be there, even if it's only 3 days after the opening, as opposed to a year and a half after the opening. Mm. But so, yes, you do have a point, and it's hard to say exactly where the problem lies.
All right. So, Peter, you went back to see Fun Home. So tell us how Fun Home is doing and why you went back.
To be perfectly frank, I went back to take a look at Circle in the Square because next Monday I'll be there emceeing the Theater World Awards, so I just want to get the lay of the land. But, you know, it's the idea of seeing Fun Home was certainly a good one, too, and especially since five new people have come in since the original cast. So that's five out of nine. And I have to say that it's in terrific shape. There's no tinge of long-run-itis whatsoever. That may be because five new people are in, but nevertheless, it's so wonderful to see it in such taut shape. What I like best about the show, though, I have to say, is and I'll talk about the performances, but this really affected me. The wonderful thing about Circle in the Square is, of course, you can see across the stage and see what other people are reacting to. Are they smiling? Are they grumpy? Are they asleep? That type of thing. And what was so wonderful is we've really reached a point in our society where people are relating to people's falling in love and not worrying about what sex they're falling in love with. This story, especially in the song I'm Changing My Major to Joan, when the girls are college, is so potent because all of us remember when we fell in love for the first time and there was nothing else in our world but that person. And it's so nice to see people tie into that and not be interested in the worst sense of the word that we're talking about two women falling in love. It seems that this audience is past that. And that's very significant because, after all, we are now a year into the run. And so the hardcore theater goers like us have already been, and we're not there anymore. And now it's a tourist audience. It's a civilian audience, if you should pardon the expression. And so it's nice to see that the civilian audience relates to the love and takes nothing else as a problem. So that was really good. I did not see Michael Cerveris. He was out, and Jim Stanek was in, an actor I've admired for a long time. He was in The Funny Thing Happened to the Way the Forum Revived some years ago. Terrific performance, really quite wonderful. So if you go and you find out Michael's out, and of course you don't want him to be because you want to see the Tony winner, the fact remains that you won't be cheated with Jim Stanek. Rebecca Luker's in, and of course this is one of our most wonderful leading ladies who just really should work more and has really never got quite the due for being as spectacular as she has. Yes, she has a lot of Tony nominations, but she doesn't have any Tonys, and I hope that changes as time goes on because she is really so special. And Janine Cesori gives her some high notes to hit. She has no problem hitting them whatsoever. That voice is still in magnificent shape. So the Pride of Alabama is still doing very well by Fun Home. Now, of course, with a new small Allison. You may recall that three different actresses play Allison. We see her in her childhood, and we now have a nice young girl named Gabriella Pizzolo, and she is really something. Now, what's really wonderful is she doesn't have a case of the cutes, as so many kids do. You know, she's not out there to say, boy, don't you think I'm terrific? None of that's there. And, of course, Sam Gold must be certainly taken as a factor there for saying, just be yourself. It's all right, you know. But there's a wonderful wonderful moment when her father is saying that he has to go to a psychiatrist. And the way this kid says, "How come?" is so chilling. It's two sentences, "how" and "come." Very, very chilling. It's a musical, of course, but nevertheless, one of the most potent parts of the show is when they're asleep. The kids are asleep, and the father is sneaking out of the house. He's going to go try to find some boyfriend somewhere, and she catches him. But that silence as he's making his way across the entire circle in the square stage, and he's just about at the door where the kid is either not asleep or wakes up and says, "Where are you going?" "Yeah, I'm going out to get a paper." And the tension is so amazing because the kid doesn't believe him. So that's really quite good, too. I have to say that Roberta Colindres, who's played Joan since the beginning, is still there, and she's really quite wonderful. Zell Steele Morrow is the kid playing the youngest of the Bechdel trio, and he gets to essentially be the lead singer in the show's title song, which is a hilarious one. And the kids are really into it. And again, nobody's trying to be cute, so that's really quite wonderful as well. So I can greatly, greatly, greatly recommend Fun Home as a significant musical, one that has really been important to a lot of people, important to audiences, but also it delivers on the fun when it has to. And while we're not talking about a show that is slam bang razzmatazz musical comedy, there certainly is comedy in it, and these people know how to land it. So Fun Home is still in great shape.
You know, interesting, I saw Curious Incident with, as I mentioned, with a friend of mine who said he had seen the, I guess, the cinecast of the production from London before the show came to Broadway. And he said, I was it the National Theater, maybe?
I think so.
Yeah.
And he said that that production was, I believe he said, was in sort of a three-quarter thrust configuration or even more of an in-the-round configuration. And when he saw it, he thought, well, how are they ever going to do this proscenium on Broadway? And then he saw the Broadway production, and oh, they did it brilliantly. And similarly, he and I had both seen Fun Home at the Public in a complete proscenium setup.
Right.
And my friend said, and I agree, but now having seen it at Circle in the Square, you think, how could it ever have worked in a proscenium setup? So so in both cases, you know, what that implies, aside from everything else, is two directors who really, really knew what they're doing.
And that the play's the thing.
Oh,
yes. You know, you know, it's funny, Michael, I had, even though I saw it at the Public, I even forgot that that was a different staging.
Exactly.
Yeah, I totally forgot. You know, I mean, it's funny, even though I know I saw it there, I really do, there's some sort of thing in my mind saying that I even saw it in the round there, which of course I did not. So I'm so used to it in the round now. So yes, your point is very well taken.
Mm. All right. So, next up in the reviews, Michael got a chance to see the encore production of Do I Hear a Waltz? So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it was wonderful. I want to say, aside from whatever flaws I may have thought that I noticed, that I am so glad that they did it. And overall, they did a really wonderful job, directed by Evan Cabinet, who is new to Encores. This is his first. And starring, let's see, Melissa Errico, Claiborne Elder, Sarah Hunt, Zachary Infante, Nancy Opel, Richard Poe, Michael Rosen, Sarah Stiles, Richard Troxell, and Karen Ziemba in the leads. 31-piece orchestra, I believe, playing the original orchestrations by Ralph Burns, gorgeously conducted by Rob Berman. This is a show that I have always thought was much better than its reputation, and apparently I'm not alone in that. To make a long story short, and especially because I'm sure many of our listeners know it, the working relationship between composer Richard Rodgers and Stephen Sondheim was quite unhappy and very difficult. And I think that, especially in terms of statements that Sondheim has made over the years many times, that colored his perception of how well the show turned out
overall. The third major member of the creative team was Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book based on his play The Time of the Cuckoo, which had also already served as the basis for a film called Summertime. And it's about a woman from America in the the musical is supposed to be set when it was performed, so that would be 1965. The play was from the 50s, so sometime late 50s, early 60s, and she travels to Italy, but she's a secretary, and she is repressed, is I guess what we would say is the modern word for it. She's repressed sexually. She's also very insecure and very lonely, and she's kind of hoping to have a magical, mystical miracle, as she puts it in the musical, occur to her, and sort of vague dreams of romance. And she does, in fact, have a romance with an Italian fellow, a very attractive Italian fellow named Renato, but it doesn't perhaps work out as well as she had hoped, and partly because she sabotages the romance because of her notions of love and sex and romance and infidelity don't necessarily comport with the way that people in Italy look at those things. And so it's a very rich piece. It's a very rich character, and I think that the musical is overall very successful with just a few issues in it. I did have some problems with the direction of Evan Cabinet, but I think that was largely due to the few inherent problems in the show and also the very, very brief rehearsal period. Overall, again, everyone did a stellar job. And I apparently Sondheim came to the dress rehearsal despite his very, very, very mixed feelings about the show. I suppose that curiosity, compelled him to attend. He was not at the talk back. I did not expect him to be. That would have been kind of amazing. But I'm just really thrilled that Encores did it. As Jack Viertel said in the talk back, he's heard so many people say this is exactly the kind of show Encores should be doing, and I thoroughly agree, and I applaud them for the effort.
Well, you're right about Sondheim being down on it. I have never been at any type of seminar where question and answers come later, where somebody says, "Mr. Sondheim, what's your favorite show?" And he always answers it by saying, "I don't have a favorite. I have a least favorite. Do I hear a waltz?" He said that. I have heard that at least six times over the years. And the thing is, once that happens, once the master of the musical theater universe says that, well, everybody has to fall in line. Say, "Oh, it's really not a good show." Okay, I'm going back to 1965. Let me tell you, in those days, we had to send in mail orders for tickets if we wanted tickets. All right, we're in Boston here at the Schubert Theater, and I used to send in my mail orders, and I used to say this: I don't care what night you send me. It doesn't matter. I just must be in the first 10 rows of the orchestra center. I only want one ticket. And the thing is, if you cannot do that, send me back my money. And the thing is, of course, I always got the ticket. I was never worried about the fact because, shows would come for 3 or 4 weeks. Do I hear a waltz? Sent back the money. Oh, my God. I almost threw myself in the Charles River. I was apoplectic. The first day the tickets actually went on sale at the box office, I cut class and went to the Schubert Theater. And the best I could do was sitting in a loge. But I had a wonderful time at this show. I think it's a terrific musical on its own terms. And the thing that Sondheim always says, and I don't understand why he says this. This is a story about a lady who can't sing. Well, the thing is, a lot of us, when we go on vacation, are different people, especially if you're looking for adventure. So this is the time in her life when she does sing. So I think there's no problem there whatsoever.
Absolutely. I agree.
The other thing, too, it's one of the reasons Amsterdam has a red light district, because people want to go away and do different things, So here she is in Venice, a very romantic place, a unique city, as Claudia Scheer reminded us in Dirty Blonde. So a place like this, and when the vacation you've saved for, you haven't had a vacation in a long time, I think it's her first time out of the country, all that kind of business, yeah, you sing. And she sings a lot of quite wonderful songs, too. And it's so wonderful, of course, in Do I Hear a Waltz, which, by the way, had one of the great cover recordings by Edie Gourmet, one of the best ever. A friend of mine at the time said, because he had heard the song over and over again on the radio, he said, boy, you know, instead of just calling this a new musical, why don't they call it a magical, mystical musical? And I think they should have. I think it's a great suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I by the way, I really must single out Melissa Errico and Richard Troxell. They were both magnificent. Melissa, it has been noted in by several people and in several reviews that she is not typecasting. She so beautiful and not dowdy in any way. But as Mr. Brantley said, sometimes casting against type really, really works. And it did in this case. She sang it beautifully and she acted it magnificently. And Richard Troxell, whom I'm sure many of our listeners are not familiar with because he's primarily an opera singer, he sang so beautifully. You could feel the reaction of everyone in the audience, and his acting was every bit on the highest level. He said that he actually had started out in musical theater playing, of all things, Bud Frump in How to Succeed. And but then his voice developed and he just went into opera. So he said it was so wonderful for him to return to musical theater, and his acting chops have remained, he certainly hasn't lost them from being in opera. He by the way, stars in a beautiful film of Madame Butterfly that was made, oh gosh, I think maybe 20 years ago. And it's so gorgeous. You can see a lot of it, maybe all of it, on YouTube. You might want to check it out. If we have a couple of minutes, yeah, Peter, I would like to ask you the other thing that Sondheim says, apparently quoting Mary Rodgers, is that Do I Hear a Waltz is an example of a why question mark musical, in the sense that it had no reason to exist because there was no reason to think that musicalizing it would add anything to the original. I want to ask you, I have never bought that concept.
No, me either. I mean, again, because she's in a foreign country. She's going to experiment. She's going to do things that she wouldn't dare do at home because the neighbors and the relatives would know what's going on, all that kind of stuff. No, now's the time to sing. There's no question about it. So I think it's a very, very spurious argument to say a why musical. I'm not sure that any property necessarily.
Well, that was actually my question. The more question. Do you think any musical is a why musical?
Of course, I have seen so many musical versions of movies in the last few years that have not seemed to add very much to them. And I think I might have been more secure in saying, nah, everything could be musicalized, than I have in the last 5 years. But I'll still err on the side of that caution in saying that, yeah, I think really anything can be a musical if the right people can do it. For example, Amazing Grace was not something that we all thought was amazing this past season, but boy, if Sondheim and Peter Stone had done it, I bet it would have been. So, because it was a great story. So, yeah, it's all about the approach. It's all about the people who are talented. It's all about the mixing together. You know, we talk about Rodgers and Sondheim not getting along, but a lot of the problem, too, was director John Dexter. Who in front of everybody referred to Elizabeth Allen one day at rehearsal as "you pig." So it really was a terrible, terrible experience about people getting along. And, if they don't get along, it's not going to turn out to be a good show. So these things are put together by human beings, and people have to act like human beings when they're with each other. And apparently John Dexter didn't. Apparently, too, he used to know the name of every male in the chorus and never learned the names of the girls in the chorus. Mm. So, what does that tell you? So it really was a very unpleasant thing. But I'll tell you, that March day at the Schubert Theater in Boston, granted, I was a teenager, but still, it was a magical, mystical miracle for me. I adored it.
All right. So, Peter, you're actually going to go see it today, right?
Yeah, Michael, one question I want to ask you, is the song Bargaining In, where he teaches her how to shop? Oh, good, because there was a revival of the George Street Playhouse back in 1999, and they dropped that song. And the important thing about that song is that's where we get to like him. And you really need that moment to get to like him, because otherwise you don't know him, you know? And, I mean, he's so fanciful there. What he does, for those people who don't know the song, he replicates a bargaining session between a shopper and a storekeeper, and the shopper is female and the storekeeper is male, and he goes from a falsetto voice to a regular voice, and it's back and forth and back and forth, and it's a lot of negotiation. And at the end, as he says, you haven't really saved a single lira, but you've won, you know, because you negotiated. So it's a very nice song, and I was very surprised they dropped it in 1999, which was the last time I think that Do I Hear a Waltz really surfaced in any way.
Richard Troxell did a very skillful job of it. The audience loved it. But this production apparently incorporates some revisions that were made by Arthur Lawrence for that George Street production, which I also saw. Penny Fuller was in that.
And
in addition to that, then this says concert adaptation by Evan Cabinet. I don't know this show that well, but just from reading the original, it seems like there was a fair amount cut in addition to the changes. So in that sense, you're not getting a 100% clear vision of what people saw back then. And then I think the main problem with this production actually involves the couple, the Yeagers, Eddie and Jennifer, because both in the way they're written and also in the way they're performed in this production, the minute you see them, they both seem so unhappy. And I don't think that's supposed to be true. I think that's supposed to be something that develops during the show. So I'm not sure why the actors or the director made that decision, and I wish they had revisited that. But then also they have reinstated the original lyrics of the song "We're Gonna Be All Right," which many people, including me, feel are a little too knowing and sophisticated for these two people, who I think are a little bit supposed to be more in denial of what is going on. And I don't know if they would be that perceptive as to exactly what their situation is.
Yeah, I have a feeling that song was written very early on. I'm guessing, because it doesn't really fit the characters. And I think that Sondheim was certainly writing this terrific lyric, an amazing lyric. And it's really sad. When I got this 73 album that we were talking about with Kurt Peterson, about the Scrabble album, as it's affectionately known, and I opened up the album to see what songs are on it, and I see "We're Going to Be All Right," and I'm thinking, my God, why is this song on here, this throwaway song that was so bland in the original production? It's a nice enough song, but it really is a throwaway. And then to find out that it became the song of the year for me, that it was such a great discovery. So yes, I'm sure it's wrong for the characters, but boy, what a piece of special material.
Well, and you're going to love this one. During the talkback, Ted Chapin read some lyrics, which I guess maybe were the original version. And one of the famous lines in the section the sections that were cut and are not on the cast album was Eddie and Jennifer are singing. First they're singing about themselves, then they start singing about other couples. And one of Eddie's observations about some other person, you know, whether fictional or whatever, is sometimes he's homosexual. And that was like, you know, et cetera, said, no, we're not going to do that. But Ted read the original lyric, which was, are you ready?
Yeah.
"At least he's not bisexual." Which to me makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that would have been more acceptable to Rogers, et cetera, but I maybe they didn't even want to go into that area at all. But I just thought that was fascinating.
Well, let's face it. I mean, Do I Hear a Waltz is 7 years before the movie of Cabaret, and a lot of people were shocked there with So Do I. And that was 7 years later. And don't forget, I mean, 65 is still before all the chaos of the 60s.
Well, absolutely.
You know, so the baby boomers were just starting to feel their oats, and that would happen much more in 68 with riots, student riots, what have you, in the the Democratic convention that was as crazy as probably this year's Republican convention will be. So under those circumstances, there was a big sea change between 65 and 72, and still in 72, when Michael York said, so do I, in terms of going to bed with Maximilian. Wow. You know, I remember being in the theater, hearing that line and saying, did I just hear what I thought I heard? You know, I mean, it was very surprising to me that that was coming in, especially because, of course, it wasn't in the original Cabaret at all. So, it would have been a very tough lyric for 65. And Rogers has been known to be homophobic.
Right.
So this was not something that he would really embrace. It's amazing that Sondheim even showed it. Him. There's a famous story about Rogers talking at a rehearsal and actually saying, handing over a paper that Sondheim had given to him, a lyric saying, this is shit.
Yeah.
So this might have been the one. I don't know that it is, but this might have been the one. So
I suspect that if Do I Hear a Waltz had opened exactly as it was 3 or 4 years later, it might have been more successful just because of that sea change that you mentioned and how adult subject matter and dark subject matter was becoming much more acceptable. Rob Berman in the talkback made the point, this is really kind of neat, that Do I Hear a Waltz comes almost exactly at the midpoint between the Sound of Music, the stage production,
and Company.
And it's almost too perfect.
Well, under those circumstances, let's go to September 25th, 1965, when Do I Hear a Waltz closed. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, here's Sondheim having a failure with Richard Rodgers. Now, Richard Rodgers at the moment is flying very high because the Sound of Music movie is 65. And and here he is. He's written two songs for it. Well-received songs for which he wrote the lyrics. We've now heard, by the way, that Saul Chaplin did some of the work. But anyway, at that time, we're thinking Richard Rodgers is writing two new songs. He doesn't need a lyricist. He has his own. Mm. Sondheim, who had this terrible failure with Anyone Can Whistle just the year before, doing music and lyrics. And don't forget, he had done Funny Thing, which was a hit, but everybody said it was in spite of him, not because of him. He did not get a Tony nomination for Best Score, while the show won Best Musical. So the point is, at the same year, Richard Rodgers won the Tony for Best Score when Sondheim wasn't even nominated for No Strings. So it does appear that Rodgers does not need a lyricist and that Sondheim needs a composer. So it's very, very interesting to think that in September of 65, this guy was down and out.
Yeah, and you know, I went to Do I Hear a Waltz with Gerard Alessandrini, and he said he was hoping that someone in the talkback would mention that 65 was the year of the Sound of Music film.
Oh, yeah.
And how can you imagine Rogers' state of mind? Sure. You know, on the one hand, this really unhappy and not very successful Broadway show, and on the other hand, that the most successful film in history,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, and you know, which of course is in many ways a much more conventional musical.
Sure.
So he must have been very confused.
yeah, and he must have, you know, at least had this because when Do I Hear a Waltz opened in March, that was when the Sound of the Music movie opened as well, the same month. So
I didn't even know that. That makes
must
it
have
even more.
Lauded it over. I mean, he must have lauded it over Sondheim, you know, because he was really flying high, you know. And of course, I don't really know what Sondheim thinks about the Sound of Music, but I can't imagine that his opinion was so different from the critics who didn't like it. That's my guess. But anyway, it's really something to indicate to all of us who, whenever we feel down and out, let's remember Sondheim 65. It took 5 years for him to come back. No shows on Broadway, no new shows between 65 and 70. But when he came back, my, did he come back. So whenever we get discouraged, let's remember this.
So true. But also, and just to end it and bring it back to Do I Hear a Waltz, despite the flaws, there were so many parts in it that work just beautifully. And you would think that they were from an absolute hit musical. And I guess sometimes the tension between those two people resulted in problems. But sometimes tension, you know, like that can result in great great work. And I think that this show evidences both of those things.
All right. That's I just sat back and listened to all that information. I really didn't participate in that. This is so wonderful to have the two of you on here. I want to thank you both for years and years of this work. It's just amazing to sit in my chair and be in awe of all the people that have come into my life because of Broadway Radio.
That's very sweet. But also, let me say, to have the opportunity to discuss such a fascinating work like this, I think that really inspires
with
us.
You.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, let's do it again next week then, okay?
All right.
And Peter will have seen Do I Hear a Waltz, so we'll revisit this again for a little while. So before we head out for the day and do trivia, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio and subscribing. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is for your iPhone and your Android device. One of our listeners pointed out that the BlackBerry thing doesn't work anymore on Stitcher, so fix that from the script.
All right.
And of course, if you don't want to listen to us in either one of those ways, our good friends at Broadway World play us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Radio. Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we talked about today. And also, Peter, there's still tickets left for the Theater World Awards.
I'm afraid not. A lot of people responded, God love you all, and I look forward to seeing you on the 23rd, but no, I can't take any more orders because people...
Actually, I guess it's not the largest venue you've been in, is it?
No, that too. So under those circumstances, I have to put a cap on that.
Absolutely, I understand that. So, all right, why don't you give us the answer to last week's trivia question?
All right. I asked, what is the difference between the 34th longest running musical in Broadway history and the other 33 that are ahead of it? Now, of course, the first thing you had to do was find out what the 34th longest running musical was. And I will say that a lot of people didn't have any problem with that. I guess they know enough to go to IMDb and figure it out that way, because there is a wonderful thing there that will tell you that type of information. So a lot of people said, all right, I know that it's Dancing. That's the one you're talking about. But what's the situation? Well, only Anthony Snitker and Phil Bond got it. And that's the fact that Dancing had no original cast album of any kind. It's funny because years later, when the show Fosse came out, Fosse had an original cast album. But Dancing had no original cast album. And it's the longest running show to have no original cast album. So that's the answer to that. This week, when Hilary Knight did the logo for Hallelujah Baby, he did a drawing of a woman with an umbrella because the opening song of the show was called When the Weather's Better, and it had everybody on stage with umbrellas. Okay, that song was cut in Boston, but they kept the logo. My point is often logos are inspired by a song in the show. However, there's one very famous musical that has a song. It was actually inspired by the logo. The logo was drawn first, and then the person writing the songs saw the logo and said, oh, I have an idea for a song based on the logo. Mm. What's the logo? What's the show? And for that matter, what's the song?
Wow. I love that. That's great. So if you have an idea of what Peter is asking about, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you were on the right track. Peter, it's funny that you were talking about the juxtaposition of IMDb and IBDb.
I do that all the time.
Last night, my wife and kids and I were at some friends. We were having a dinner party over at some friend's house, and we were talking about some movies and television shows and things like that. And we couldn't remember something, and they said, "Oh, you know, let's look it up." And I kept on going to IBDb instead of IMDb. So I do, you know, I'm like just muscle memory typing it out. You know,
exactly.
It's very funny. I'm like, oh, I can't look up this movie on IBDb, but That's very funny. All right. So we appreciate our listeners for listening to This Week on Broadway. We'll be back next week. And until then, thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thought I'll ever know. Everywhere I go, you'll be.
Began tonight. I saw you and the world went away. Tonight, tonight, there's only you tonight. What you are, what you do, what you say.
What was just a word is a story.